Yes.
Okay, well, let's begin then. I'm Chris Wickham, and I'm chair of the history faculty, and I've been involved with the Canterbury Institute in its inception, so I'm very pleased to be chairing this particular paper, but I'm also particularly pleased to be chairing Khalil, whose doctoral thesis I supervised 20 years ago. At that point, he was in and out of jail in Turkey, would come on the bus to Britain to have supervisions and then go back again, sometimes to jail, but sometimes not, I'm allowed to say. Since then, he got a job at Boisici University, and he is now at Sabancı, and he's turned into one of Turkey's principal public intellectuals. And so here, Khalil on the Kemalist Sonderweg, on Turkey's Sonderweg and Kemalism and Nazi Hikmet, is something that's going to be worth hearing. So over to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be chaired by Chris. As I was just saying to Chris, when I sent in the second version of my title, that is to say, Kemalism and Communism and the Turkish Communist Poet Nazım Hikmet, the Turkish Sonderweg, the Turkish Special Path, through the eyes of one of the leading communist poets of the 20th century. When I sent in that version of my title, I was working very hard on a still unfinished book on Nazım Hikmet. And so I was obsessed with his idealization and underwriting of Kemalism and the Kemalist Revolution. I will still be mentioning this, but the final version of this paper that will now be before you is not going to be centered so strongly on the Turkish Communist Left and Nazım Hikmet in the 1930s. But the Turkish Sonderweg will definitely be there. What is the Sonderweg idea? It is the idea probably originating with Prussian Bismarckian Germany in the second half of the 19th century, that for various reasons we represent, whoever we happen to be, we represent a special case and our path is a special path. Originally in the hands of Friedrich List and the German Historical School of Political Economy, the National Economy School, this developed in contradistinction to classical English liberalism and liberal political economy, liberal thought in general. The idea spread. And, of course, Bismarck in Germany itself, and the Sonderweg idea became very strong as part of quasi-official hegemonic ideology in Germany. It also became very strong in Russia, in Japan, in China, in the late Ottoman Empire and the modern Turkish Republic, spreading thence to the rest of the non-European world, the Third World. I mean, we can, in various ways, Nasserism, Ba'athism, Gaddafi, the recently overthrown Libyan dictator, when he came to power, he was very hot on formulating Libya's own third path or special path between the capitalist West and the communist Soviet Union. So all these claims at following a special trajectory or path of history, not only do they entail in real material terms specific programs, platforms, agendas of this or that variant of national developmentalism, but they also have enormous ideological, mental, historiographical repercussions. That is to say, it is not simply a real material trajectory of economic or social or political development that we are talking about. It is a whole set of attitudes. In Turkey, the classical formulation of the Turkish Sonderweg idea is due to a speech made by none other than Mustafa Kemal himself in the Turkish Grand National Assembly in the year 1921. 1918, World War I ended. Of course, together with the other Central Powers, the Ottoman Empire was also catastrophically defeated. It had been forced to sign the Mudros Armistice of 1918, and at the continuing Paris Peace Conference, eventually something called the Sèvres Peace Treaty would be drawn up, eventually in 1920, which called for a comprehensive partitioning of the Ottoman Empire. But what happened in late 1918, early 1919, was surviving elements of the modernist nationalist Committee of Union and Progress, then the ruling party in the late Ottoman Empire, İttihat ve Terakki Cemiyeti, as it is known in Turkish. They had long been preparing for the possibility of a national resistance in Anatolia in the case of such an eventuality coming to pass. And in fact, in early 1919, Mustafa Kemal and some other leading military and bureaucratic cadres crossed over from occupation Istanbul, Istanbul under British and Entente occupation, to Anatolia. They started going around and organizing the local gentry and notables, the local leaders of Anatolian Turkish Muslim society, for a last-ditch national resistance against what they regarded as final colonization, final partitioning and colonization. And the resistance did get going from 1919 onwards. 3.5 years of the national struggle, what is known in Turkey as Turkey's War of Independence, eventually resulted with the defeat of the main threat to the Turkishness of Anatolia, that is to say the Greek Expeditionary Army, that was at the time supported by the British government under David Lloyd George. And the victory of the Turkish national struggle eventually led to the promulgation of the modern Republic of Turkey in October 1923. In the midst of this, in the year 1921, at an as yet relatively undecided stage of the national resistance, in the sense that the Greek Expeditionary Army was, you know, putting very heavy pressure on the Western Front, in Western Anatolia, and the great and decisive battles of Sangarios-Sakarya, and then the final offensive of late 1922 were still to come. Mustafa Kemal's charisma had not yet been ensured by these victories to come. So he was not yet in a politically unchallengeable position. And he was using all his considerable political skills to try and control the Grand National Assembly that he had himself led in setting up in Ankara. There was a first group, so-called, of his supporters, that is to say, those strongly modernist nationalist elements, survivals of the Committee of Union and Progress, who were decided on, very set on going through with this last-ditch national resistance. And at the same time, there was a second group, so-called, second group, capital S, capital G, at the time, who were relatively oppositional, who seemed and who were supportive of the idea of a national resistance, but who had various anxieties and qualms about supporting Mustafa Kemal's leadership, because previously, before them, they had the previous experience of Enver Pasha and how he had grown into a military dictator leading the triumvirate of Enver, Talat and Jamal from 1913-1918. And with the previous examples of the unionist triumvirate before them, they were worried about Mustafa Kemal becoming yet another dictator, which in the event he eventually did become. So the second group in Parliament, in the Grand National Assembly, was looking for all kinds of ways to politically corner and outmaneuver Mustafa Kemal. And in 1921, they launched a parliamentary debate about What are we? What is this government of the Grand National Assembly? Is this a democracy? Is this a Western-style democracy? Is this a truly parliamentary kind of democracy? Or is this some kind of and pointing towards and intending to develop further towards a Soviet-type regime? And they put the question to Mustafa Kemal, because after all, the nationalists were waging a war of national resistance against a Greek expeditionary army, strongly supported by Great Britain, and they were receiving help from the Soviet Union. And what was in the future to be called the Turko-Soviet friendship, cemented in person by Mustafa Kemal and Lenin, was in the making. So it was in response to this kind of political ideological challenge that Mustafa Kemal got up. He was the chair of the, he was the president of the assembly. He was not prime minister. He was president of the assembly. He got up and made a famous speech about how the Turkish Revolution, the Turkish national resistance, represents a totally new path on earth. An unprecedented experiment. We represent neither the Western liberal capitalist principle nor the Soviet Bolshevik communist principle, which he hinted we consider alien to our socio-political constitution. We represent a new principle of government, which I shall term the national principle. Gentlemen, efendiler, we resemble nobody else, we resemble only ourselves. This, in so many words, became the classical, the succinct statement of self-particularization in the Sonderweg outlook in at an early stage in 1921 in the making of modern Turkey. Now, what I propose to do today, if I can manage it, is to try and explore the differences between the Prussian Bismarckian special path and the Kemalist special path. Very clearly, there are very many things in common. There is a common problem of being late in the development of capitalist modernity. Real or perceived, there is a very deep perception of somehow having missed the bus. Great Britain, France, Western Europe, they have developed ahead of us. We are lagging behind. And this engenders a catching up agenda. How can we catch up? How can we catch up and rejoin the leaders in this race for modernity? That becomes a common, in fact, it is common to all the examples that I mentioned at the outset. It is common to Germany, Turkey, Japan, China, Russia, Tsarist Russia, and then the Soviet Union, and so on and so forth. And again, there is this other feature that is very much in common. This catching up mentality and agenda engenders a forced march, an acceleration of modernization from the top down, through the imposition of enormous coercion on society from above, through the state, sometimes through a one-party state, very frequently through a one-party state, whether in its Kemalist version or it's in its communist version, to implement, to accelerate programs of social and economic development, trying to steal a forced march on modernity, as it were. And in this regard, the statements of Mustafa Kemal and many statements by Stalin are quite comparable. We have to catch up with the West in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years or so, whatever, otherwise they will crush us. And it is one reason, perhaps not the only reason, but it is one reason why the political outcome is a one-party state, not only a one-party state, but a very authoritarian kind of political culture, with authority ultimately vested in the one party and kicked up further into its central committee, kicked up further into its political bureau, kicked up further into it, the standing committee of the political bureau, and kicked up even further into the hands of the supreme leader, the first chairman or the general chairman, the first secretary, the general secretary of the party, or the president of the republic, some father of the nation kind of figure. Another common element between the Prussian Bismarckian path and the Kemalist path is that the army and the state, the army, the bureaucracy, the judiciary, the army and sub-branches of the army, eventually developing into the rest of the state organization, end up playing God to the nation. It is not society that begets the state or is perceived to have engendered, created the state. It is vice versa. At least in terms of perceptions, there arises a very strong perception of the army and the state having given rise to the nation, to have fashioned the nation, and not vice versa. All these are common elements. And as I've said, my question becomes, what difference? On top of all this, what differences, real and ideational, in the Maurice Godelier sense, what differences can we point to between the Turkish Sonderweg and its predecessor, the Bismarckian, the Prussian special path? And now, what I propose to do is I want to take you through some texts, and I will put some texts before you, and I will try to finger certain interesting points about them. And once I'm through pointing this out, I will revert to the theoretical background, the possible theoretical explanations for this. My texts are taken from early 20th century Turkish literature because increasingly over the last 10-15 years or so, I have been moving more and more into the sphere of critical studies of Turkish nationalism, using literature, the period's literature, as my key sources. When I did this PhD thesis 20 years or so ago with Chris, I was working on 20th century Turkish Republican nationalist historians' constructions of the Ottoman Empire. So one leg was like in medieval history and one leg was in Turkish nationalism studies. What has happened since then is, I'm afraid, I have not gone in the direction of medieval history and historiography so much as Turkish nationalism and the construction of Turkish national memory. So, this, I hope you can read this. This is not Nazım Hikmet. This is Mehmet Akif, famous Turkish Islamic, moderate Islamist, modernist kind of reforming kind of poet in the early 20th century. He is the author of the Turkish National Anthem. In fact, it was in the same critical year of 1921 that the Grand National Assembly in Ankara launched a competition for a national anthem, and it was eventually Mehmet Akif who came up with the lyrics that were accepted and which we unfortunately continue to sing to this day. Before that, he had written this. This is an excerpt from his 1915 Hymn to the Martyrs of Gallipoli. And of course, it lies at the intersection of British with British and French and Anzac with Turkish history. Once the Gallipoli campaign was nearly concluded with an Ottoman-Turkish victory, in the sense that they were able to retain control of the peninsula, Mehmet Akif wrote this fervent Islamic Turkish proto-nationalist hymn that is filled with Islamic motifs. And This is my own translation. As far as I know, no other English translation exists. This is from the opening pages of the poem. So he speaks about a bunch of merciless predatory hyenas that, with the savagery they display, immediately identify themselves as Europeans. The first two lines are immediately interesting. Why is this crucial? Because this is a reversion of the terms used by 19th century Eurocentrist anthropology to refer to the primitives, to the primitives of Africa, the tribal peoples of the Third Belt, the peoples without history. They are described as still living in a stage of savagery or barbarism, depending on whether they are hunters-gatherers or early farmers, etc. But Mehmed Akif is deliberately taking those terms and reversing them and reapplying them to Europe and Europeans. It is, if you think of Mark Mazower's book, The Dark Continent, Europe's 20th century, I mean, the real dark continent was not Africa, but is Europe. It is a much earlier, 100 years earlier, much more emphatic statement of the same kind. What is interesting is the familiarity that he has with Eurocentric discourse. That is one thing that I'm trying to underline. And then, now, all right, this is a David and Goliath kind of polarization, us and them, imperialists assaulting us. And then he speaks about everybody having descended on us, the Ottoman Turks. Behold the seven climes of the world. Look there by the side of Australia is Canada. All kinds of faces, a whole variety of skins and languages, and yet the simple truth is in savagery they are the same. In imperceptible fashion, he has moved from calling imperialist Europe savage and predatory to calling everybody except the Turks savage and predatory and etc. And furthermore, there comes this interesting phase. Some are Hindus, some cannibals, others I know not what scourge. Hindus, he is referring to the Gurkha troops in the British Expeditionary Force. Cannibals, he is referring to the Senegalese tirailleurs that were part of the French Expeditionary Force at Gallipoli. What has happened is, on the one side, there is his hatred of European imperialism expressed in the opening lines, and on that basis, you might think that he is going to call for a broad, universal, anti-imperialist alliance against the lords of humankind, etc. But into it, there creeps a very different note towards the end. In fact, it is a Eurocentrist kind of discourse. When he speaks of some are Hindus, some cannibals, he is, in effect, adopting the vocabulary, the discourse of, you know, any imperialistically minded Englishman or Frenchman against the primitive peoples of the world. So where is he? Is he a consistent anti-imperialist, or is he with European civilization against the rest? Okay, my first text. Secondly, so this is late 1915, early 1916. My other snippets are going to come from somebody called Ömer Seyfettin, very famous Turkish author of the early 20th century, in fact a unionist, and personally very close to Enver Pasha, in constant touch with the unionist Central Committee and headquarters and the military triumvirate, a very, very militant Turkish nationalist who absolutely rejected any idea of trying to maintain a multinational Ottoman Empire opting very clearly for a purely national, ethnically homogeneous Turkish nation state. A very powerful writer. In late 1911, in December 1911, he published a story called Primo, a Turkish Boy. This is a very important story in Turkish nationalist literature. It is in the aftermath of Italy's attack on Tripoli, on Libya, earlier in the year. And the Ottoman attempt, in fact, both Enver and Mustafa Kemal, as relatively young officers, went to fight to try and organize the local Arab Muslim resistance against the Italian invasion. Primo, a very brief summary. There is this young engineer by the name of Kenan, who has been, who is totally westernized. He's gone to the best late 19th century Turkish schools, Ottoman schools, and then he has been educated in Europe. He has internalized European Western culture to such an extent that he has become a traitor to his own nation. He has acquired a totally cosmopolitan worldview. Horror of horrors, he's a universalist, he's a humanist, he's a Freemason, which is just about the ultimate sin in the eyes of Turkish nationalism at that time. And he has, Ömer Seyfettin puts ideas in his mouth in terms of his internal monologues that are very reminiscent of Karkowski's argument for an ultra-imperialism, imperialism leading to a peaceful world government at the time. But what happens is, as a result of Italy's invasion of Libya, Kenan goes through a very rude awakening and a profound internal transformation. In a matter of 2 days or so, he converts from his pro-Western ideas to all the positions of a very militant unionist Turkish nationalist, and the story is about his transformation as well as the transformation of his young son. Kenan happens to have to be married to Grazia, an Italian woman, and they have had a son born to them, and so cosmopolitan are they that they have named their son Primo, their firstborn. And in the course of the story, not only Kenan, but also Primo, this young Turkish boy who doesn't even speak proper Turkish, who is fluent in Italian and French, goes through a profound nationalist reawakening. Okay, this is the context. Now, early in the story, Kenan is walking up and down the waterfront of still Ottoman Salonika, Thessaloniki. This is before the Balkan Wars of 1912 and the eventual loss of Salonika, the royal Greek nation state. And Kenan is walking up and down, and he is coming face to face with the reality of Western imperialism. These first two or three pages, they could have been, they have a quasi-Marxist tone. One can imagine something very similar being written by Rudolf Hilferding or Rosa Luxemburg or by Lenin himself, 90% of the time. It is worth remembering that some leading theorists of the Second International, like Parvus, the pen name used by Alexander Helfand, were frequent contributors to Young Turk journals at this time, and they were trying to propagate the idea of an anti-imperialist united front. They were trying to throw this idea at the Young Turks. So Kenan comes face to face with all the crimes that France and the British have been committing in the name of universal humanity, in the name of modernity. So he enumerates the crimes and the possessions of French imperialism in Africa, and then he goes on to enumerate the crimes and the enormous possessions of British imperialism in Africa. In between, there is this interesting sentence that I have highlighted. France had for the past 100 years been drenching Africa in blood, machine gunning the unarmed, naive, innocent, noble, friendly, and good-natured children of the Sahara, using its rapid-fire cannon to destroy tranquil cities and peaceful homes, etc., etc. Why is this interesting? Because it yet again has to do with the importation and internalization of an idea that originally belongs to European thought and Eurocentrism. This is the noble savage idea. Okay, this is not reality. This is noble savage ideology. I have highlighted it as with Mehmet Akif. What is interesting is the extent to which they were familiar with, and they had come to accept the tropes and modalities of Eurocentrist thought. So that it is cropping up without thinking, as it were. All he is after is to underlie the enormity of French colonial crimes in Africa, but the language that he is using, he is resorting to, the vocabulary that he's using, is actually coming out of that very Eurocentric thought. If we go further, so he goes through this. This is, these are two, you know, very strongly written, very powerfully written, two or three pages about imperialism, and we come to these words at the top right now. What kind of humanity was this? In what way was this humanity any different from savagery, barbarism, or cannibalism? Having entirely conquered an unarmed Africa, these predatory, merciless, terrible Europeans, virtually the same words as Mehmet Akif 3 years later in his Hymn to the Martyrs of Gallipoli, the same reversal of 19th century European anthropological vocabulary, the application of the same epithets to civilized Europe, predatory, merciless, terrible. You know, 3 years earlier, this is December 1911, 4 years earlier, Mehmet Akif's hymn will be late 1915, early 1916, and the vocabulary and the turn of speech, the entire paradigm, the entire sources of intellectual inspiration are the same. Look at this. These vile, cheating Europeans were given to faking a lovable humanitarianism at home, consisting of setting up charity fairs and other benevolent institutions, even organizing societies for the protection of animals. For the Turkish nationalists of this time, this is the ultimate hypocrisy, societies for the protection of animals. In fact, I will try to show later how, for Nazım Hikmet, the communist poet of the 1930s and subsequently, societies for the prevention of cruelty to animals become an imperialist conspiracy of some sort against Republican Turkey. And he will be using the same vocabulary. If we go down, all right, he continues talking about, you know, many, many things are very, very realistic. He goes on to talk about the hypocrisies of the Opium War, etc. And then finally, he comes to what this European imperialism has in store for Turkey, for the Ottoman Empire. By the way, Ömer Seyfettin never uses the term Ottoman Empire. It is always Turkey for him, because he is always retrospectively Turkifying the Ottoman Empire all the way back to its beginnings in the early 14th century. He never, never refers to it as the Ottoman Empire. It is, for him already, a nation state read backwards, if you want. The embryonic Turkish nation state from the beginning, which no serious historian, of course, would agree with. But look at this. Turkey, too, was certain to be partitioned, for they regarded her as an obstacle in the way of pillaging Asia. This is very much in the same vein as Mehmet Akif's opening lines. So it was she that first had to be weakened and destroyed. Now, it was nearly a century ago that Europeans had moved against us, inventing Greece by setting fire to our fleet at Navarin, Romania, Serbia, Montenegro, Bulgaria, Eastern Rumelia, Algeria, Tunisia, Cyprus, Egypt, and the Sudan had been seized as loot, one after another. What is the problem here? He is making all national revolts and struggles of independence against the Ottoman Empire, he's making all that appear as imperialist invasion, as expansion. In doing so, he is subtly defending the Ottoman Empire subjection of these peoples. This is like a birthright. This is not to be questioned. You know, it is if these lands went their own ways, they were taken from us by imperialists. And the national aspirations, the national struggles for independence of these peoples, etc., they don't count for anything. They don't even exist. Okay? What's interesting is, again, how quickly anti-imperialism can turn into defending our empire against modern imperialism. This, I'm going to argue, is the inner contradiction of Turkish nationalism. On the one hand, it was and it perceived itself to be victimized by the great powers, but also it had its own empire and its own subject peoples. So it is double-sided. He goes on, the plans to remove us from the face of the earth were still in force. Bosnia-Herzegovina grabbed by force. The Macedonian question, Albania, the Cretan question, the question of the Straits, Eastern Anatolia, meaning Kurdistan and Armenia, the Mesopotamian question, Iraq, Syrian independence, this is all an imperialist conspiracy. For Ömer Seyfettin and his entire generation, defending what is ours is equivalent to defending the Ottoman Empire. Although he keeps Turkifying in real and imaginary terms the Ottoman Empire, nevertheless, they are trying to take from us what is rightfully ours. Somewhat later in the same story, as I said, his son Primo is going through his own awakening. He has this friend at school, Orhan, who happens to be the son of the local Ottoman Pasha in Salonika. And Orhan is already a fervent young Turkish nationalist, and quickly he converts Primo. They happen to be somewhere in town, and the Young Turks in Istanbul have published a statement, a declaration, and Orhan is reading to Primo this Young Turks tract from an Ottoman Turkish newspaper, except that he's translating it into French as he goes along, because Primo cannot properly understand Turkish. What is interesting about this is the back and forth between, once more, posturing as innocent victims of imperialism and also propounding an imperialist, a conquering, subjecting ideology of their own. The Turks were one of the bravest, noblest, strongest nations on earth. Theirs was a line of kings, emperors, Hakans, beys, emirs. They had ruled over Asia for centuries. Attila had crushed Europe, causing them to whine like dogs. This is a kind of Turkish nationalism that keeps complaining over victimization while at the same time boasting of once having made Europeans whine like dogs. The Turks had led the way to civilization. Everywhere they went, they had taken heroic qualities, a clean blood, a pure morality, regeneration and natural selection with them. A clean blood, a pure morality, regeneration and natural selection with them. What is this an echo of? What is the source of inspiration behind this? It is an echo of 19th century German nationalist literature about the Germanic invasions having regenerated a corrupt, degenerate, and doomed late Roman Empire. One. More generally, the vocabulary is taken from early 20th century proto-fascism. Okay. This emphasis on race, this emphasis on a clean blood, regeneration, natural selection, very strongly hinting at social Darwinism, it is taken from early 20th century proto-fascist ideology. He continues about the glories of the Chinggisid, Timurid, Ottoman past, and then he comes to this line. And now all of them, the Europeans, were trying to expel them, the Ottomans, from their colonies in Africa. The word he uses in Turkish is müstemleke, which is old early 20th century Turkish for what is today called sömürge, and it means hollow. The thing is this, the Ottomans never ever regarded their outlying provinces as colonies. They never used this word müstemleke. They were the well-protected domains of the Sultan. And whether these provinces were in Africa or in the Arab lands or in the Balkans did not make any difference. They did not think of themselves as a modern imperialist empire, an empire of the era of the new imperialism. They thought of themselves, they thought of their political animal as a very different kind of organism, and they never used the word colony for their outlying provinces. What Ömer Seyfettin is doing is he's deliberately substituting a modern European word for the old standard Ottoman traditional political vocabulary, terminology, by way of arguing we too have an empire. That is to say, we too are an empire like modern European empires, which becomes an additional source of Turkish national pride. From a phase even earlier in the story, there comes, this is Kenan, one of Kenan's inner monologues. And this I have not highlighted because I would have had to highlight everything in it. Kenan is thinking about his past, and he remembers how he had always hated war. The philosopher who said war is life itself, he regarded as nothing but a red monster. He hated Darwin, too, for demonstrating that the act of struggle in the organic world was also necessary and indispensable for society, for mankind. Ömer Seyfettin and his generation never read Darwin. They took Darwin to be straight away, simply and directly, social Darwinists. What they read was German vulgarizers of Darwin, like Ernst Haeckel and others, that is to say, the vulgar naturalist materialists of the 19th century, in fact, the inventors of social Darwinism. I will leave aside the question of to what extent social Darwinism may be said to be embryonically present in Darwin himself or not. The point is, they only read vulgarizers and simplifiers of Darwin, and they were, as Şükrü Hanioğlu and many others have repeatedly noted, they were very strongly social Darwinistic. It doesn't stop at that. Look at the abuse that he heaps on dreams of what he calls dreams of a universal humanity. A dream of humanity is what? It is an idyllic poem shared by all those lazy, cowardly, and sick thinkers who immerse themselves in illusions without ever touching upon reality. This, Kenan is shared, has been shared. A plethora of virtues, of the truth, the origins, or the secondary causations of which he remained ignorant, stood like smoke-carved, huge but disembodied fetishes in the mirage of a temple that he kept in his mind.
What Ömer Seyfettin is doing is he's attacking the idea of a universal ethics, a binding ethics for humanity. European imperialist great powers, all right, they have been hypocritical, they have used double standards in applying or defending or propagating notions of a universal humanity. His answer to that, his response, is not to ask them to be consistent, but to conclude very quickly that this is all rubbish. There is no such thing, there should be no such thing as ethics or morality or virtue anyway. These are unscientific concepts. This is a young Turks generation, this is a unionist generation, famous for its worship of what it took to be science. Science or pseudoscience. Everything had to be scientific, everything had to be demonstrated, proved, defended by the positive sciences, and in the face of scientific conclusions, ethics or morality or moral virtues did not count for anything. Why is this an ideal notion of virtue and humanity? These two vague and general words that actually had no fixed exact meaning had come to dominate his mind against all reason and logic, all science and truth, turning him into a living cadaver. This passage, I had already noted a smattering of words in an earlier passage. This is, in fact, a very strong statement of proto-fascism. I mean, there is in this virtually every element of late 19th and early 20th century proto-fascism that we can think of. Why is this so interesting? Because we have three pages of a quasi-Marxist anti-imperialist pamphlet in the making, and side by side with it, in fact, just a page and a half earlier, we have this proto-fascist diatribe. And it says something enormous about not one but two very strong ideological sources of unionist Young Turk nationalism. They are taking anti-imperialism from a Marxist or Marxian or quasi-Marxian literature just as easily. They are taking proto-fascist ideology via the channel of German nationalists. A lot has been said in the past about how Republican Turkey, in its era of tradition-shattering reforms in the 1920s and 30s under Mustafa Kemal, may be said to have been strongly influenced by French Jacobinism, by the French Revolution. Generations of scholars, I think not only I but many people think, have considerably overlooked the much stronger influence of German nationalism on the Young Turks. It is very much evident in this quotation. Right, this is the gist of it. Now, for a quick theoretical explanation, I am notorious for running over my time in papers, and I know Marius is apprehensive and Chris is apprehensive about this, so I will conclude in 5 minutes. This is why I put the texts first. What is this all about? First, the 18th and 19th century Ottoman elites developed a complex love and hate relationship with Europe, admiring and emulating a civilization of steam and steel, as it gradually grew, especially after the Industrial Revolution, but also constantly resenting, grumbling, and grouching against the great power interventions of the long 19th century. They were constantly vacillating between the love aspect and the hate aspect. It led to, as in Russia, as in Japan, as in China, it led also to enormous debates about what to take and what not to take. Like the Europhiles and Slavophiles in Russia. What to take from the West, what not to take from the West. Ziya Gökalp, for example, the elite and sometimes much too abstruse theorists of early Turkish nationalists argued for taking medeniyet, but not Fars. Argued for taking civilization, but not culture. Not culture and tradition. By civilization, he meant science and technology. By culture, he meant what universally appeals to nationalists all over the world as the core of our national genius or the core of our national identity. So they debated back and forth about what to take and what not to take. And they took the science and technology, not only that, but they also imported the European army and the European style bureaucracy and European finances and modes of administration and weights and measures and banknotes, etc., etc. In the midst of all these debates about what to take and what not to take, without realizing it, unconsciously, they also took something, they imported and internalized something, which they did not even realize they were importing and internalizing. They imported Eurocentrism. They imported the entire Eurocentric structures and inner connections of European thought. In the 19th century, European elite thinking perceived of the world as consisting of three concentric circles or bells. In the inner core, the core of the Wallersteinian modern world system, there were the historical nations, Hegel's historical nations. They're passed to be studied by the new departments of history in the 19th century, and their present to be studied by the new social sciences of economics, government or political science, and sociology. In the outer belt, the third belt, were the primitives, the people without history, so-called, and the academic discipline designated to study them as its subject matter was 19th century anthropology, which was, of course, a very far cry from today's anthropology, and at least as physical anthropology as it was social anthropology. In between, in the second belt, were the so-called high civilizations, Islam in general, or maybe more specifically the Ottoman Empire and Persia, and maybe also Mughal India, as well as China and Japan, which were the object of the new department, the new centers or institutes of Oriental studies, and hence closely wedded to the generation of Orientalist ideology. I'm not going to pursue Edward Said into that. I only want to note this. The Ottomans imported and internalized first the late Ottoman elites and then Turkish nationalist elites, adopted and internalized this entire mental construct. They came to perceive of themselves, yes, in the second belt, in the second division, in football league tables, constantly facing the threat of relegation, dropping down into the third division where they would be with the primitives and be fair game for colonization. With the Hindus and cannibals of Mehmed Akif's critical line. And against that, the only cure was to try and secure promotion into the first division. That is to say, to somehow gain admission, entry into the concept of Europe or the family of advanced civilized nations. This was a matter of not just trying to achieve, to catch up with, and trying to achieve the same levels of performance as European capitalist modernity, but also trying to represent themselves in ideological terms as already European, as already belonging with the lords of humankind. Hence the inner contradictions, hence the occasional reference to an imagined anti-imperialist united front of belts 2 plus 3 against circle 1, and the just as frequent quick reversion to going with belt one against belt three, against the Hindus and cannibals and the primitives in belt three. Worse yet, the more they tried to imagine themselves, not just achieve themselves, but also imagine themselves into belt one, the more they started looking for their own real or imagined underlings. Just as we must also have ironclads and redcoats, we also must have our own primitives. And they started looking for these inside Ottoman society, turning self-colonizer to their own traditional historical space, and they found the primitives that they could lord it over in the person of, for example, the Arabs and the Kurds. And this explains an enormous amount about the continuing ferocity of modern Turkish nationalism against the Kurds, which for the last 100 years, starting with this, have been regarded as our primitives. It is not just a matter of the outer primitives in Africa, the Hindus and cannibals, etc., but of also Turkish nationalism discovering or inventing or imagining or constructing its own inherently inferior races inside its own historical space. Hence all the dichotomies that we keep observing in these texts. Thank you for your patience.